First of all, I think many of you know as well as I do that perhaps one of the most important phenomena in Latin America in the 20th century is, in fact, the expanded presence of China as a trading partner, as an investor, in terms of exchange. The leading trade investment partner for a number of countries in South America. This is something extremely new for many of us who live in Latin America. I'm originally born in the United States, but I've lived for over 20 years in Peru, and I'm a Peruvian citizen. This has really been a major change for us this century. The demands of China, as China has grown, has really promoted growth and expansion in many of our countries as demands for the materials that we export increased exponentially. But also raised legitimate concerns about sort of reconcentration in primary commodity exports, which a lot of our countries have been trying to grow, to move out of, as well as the environmental and social impact of the kind of investment and the kind of trade we've been doing with China. There's a lot of concerns and a lot of debate about that. It's also raised concerns, and this is where I came to the topic, about the sort of social, environmental, and labor practices of Chinese firms operating overseas in Latin America. Their ability, doubts about their ability to comply with global standards, particularly in the extractive industries, and doubts about the ability or the will of our governments and our authorities to regulate them and to hold them to the standards that we've been trying to develop. And it's in that context that we embarked on a project really with eyes wide open, really trying to ask the questions objectively on China and Latin America, lessons for South-South cooperation and sustainable development. The results of our eight-country studies have been published as a working paper series online at the Global Economic Governance Initiative website at Boston University. It's been published in Chinese, and we've been working with colleagues at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences CAS on this. And just this week published in Spanish by Universidad Pacifico Press. For those who want to read it in Spanish, I'll pass it around. I have just one copy, but you'll be able to get it soon online as well. And the questions that drove this project that I've been working on and colleagues have been working on were really two very simple. Simple to ask, not so easy to answer. Has China been an independent driver of social and environmental change in Latin America in this recent bonanza period? And do Chinese investors have different environmental or social records than their international or domestic counterparts? There's more macro questions and more micro questions that drove our study. And I don't know if you can see this. These are the teams that worked with us, very diverse in terms of discipline, in terms of the sectors we're working on. Although those two questions have really driven each of our country case studies, it's a lot of material with varied kind of results. We have colleagues from the Universidad de Buenos Aires in Argentina, colleagues from Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Mexico, and Peru. Where, as I said, I have a co-author, Victoria Chongqing, on my project. And yet, although there's a lot of diversity, and I'm going to discuss some of the diversity at the end, how Peru stacks up or not to some of the experiences of other countries, and all of the country case studies are online at the Boston University website. Yes?
Are they the main industry, the main country?
Yes, those are the... In the case of Chile is very different, because Chile has not had the kind of significant Chinese presence and direct investment some of the rest of us had. China is a major... purchaser of Chilean copper, but in fact the main presence of China in Chile has been in the area of solar energy. So that's a bit of a different case than most of us who are both exporting primary commodities to China and receiving direct investment in our leading sectors. But the case of Chile, for example, is different because it's about solar energy, and the case of Mexico is about manufacturing. So they are distinct, and there's a lot of rich material in the individual working papers from each country that are on the website. Nonetheless, I'm just going to mention some of the general findings that cut across the eight-country studies that we tried to pull out of all this rich material. One of them was, yes, China's been an independent driver of environmental degradation and social conflict during the recent period of commodities boom in Latin America. There's been a higher concentration of primary exports in what we sell to China than to the rest of the world. Foreign direct investment from China has also been more highly concentrated in these sectors than other forms of direct foreign investment from other countries. And Latin American exports to China have used more water on the whole than exports to other parts of the world and support fewer jobs. They're in industries that have a high concentration of use of water and other natural resources and a low tendency to produce jobs directly. We also found that in a number of cases, foreign direct investment from China, a number of these countries, particularly countries bordering on the Amazon, China's investment is very prominent in areas of very high biodiversity, fragile environmental areas, and in some cases indigenous populations as well, vulnerable populations. The book and the working paper series have a series of maps that were done by a wonderful environmental economist named Rebecca Ray at UMass Amherst, in which they highlight some of the concentration of China's investment in different parts of the region with high levels of biodiversity. You can look at them more closely online. We also commented that Chinese safeguards, in terms of, we looked at, this is something we're going to work on more in another round of the project, comparing the safeguards that the Chinese government has or the Chinese development banks have with Western banks and safeguards that are trying to be implemented in the region, and found that the Chinese, although the Chinese government is extremely, increasingly concerned about the safeguards and the standards of its overseas investment, it's something, there's a number of new guidelines and standards that have been set, for example, by the different development banks and over the larger national champion companies. But in fact, their safeguards are relatively weak, particularly in the area of having independent grievance mechanisms and in the area of transparency. So you may have safeguards that are very similar on paper to those of the World Bank or IDB, IFC, and yet in practice, the ability to carry a grievance or to make a demand when something's been violated is much harder, as many of us know. What we found in most of these cases, and it was certainly the case for Peru, was that Chinese investors and the banks that are supporting them are learning very quickly to adapt to what's being demanded of them in our region and to comply with the highest standards that we demand them to comply with. And that's why one of the messages from our study is the importance of not backtracking on the kind of standards that a number of our countries, Peru, Chile, Ecuador, have been trying to exact on the extractive industries more generally. And the other thing we found was that we don't see the so-called pollution haven model. It's not as though China's investing in countries with lower standards. Most Latin American countries now have higher standards on these industries than those at home in China. So in fact, the Chinese have to level up in terms of compliance, both in the area of labor and social impact, cultural impact, and environmental impact. Our message is that it's fundamental for our authorities and our governments to maintain our regulatory standards, and we see some worrisome slippage going on in a number of countries, including my own in Peru, which I'll mention. Moving to the Peruvian case, the relationship between Peru and China is a long one. Some of you know Peru has one of the largest Chinese descendant populations in the world outside of China, and the largest in Latin America, I believe. And it's a relationship that goes back to the 19th century, in which Peru imported over 100,000 Chinese men to work on railroads and in rubber tapping and other areas. But the recognition of the People's Republic of China was in 1971, when a number of countries in the region recognized China. It would take another 20 years for the first significant Chinese investment to come to Peru. Our relationship with China was very low intensity in the 70s and 80s. But in the early 90s, when the Alberto Fujimori administration in Peru privatized literally all of the productive sectors of the economy, a very radical, intense privatization campaign, the Chinese were the very first to purchase a privatized mining project, both mining and oil, in Peru. It's the very first Chinese overseas investment in Latin America and the very first company privatized in Peru, which was the Shugang Hierro Peru iron ore operation, a very old operation that's been around since the 50s and was at the time in government hands. It would take another 15 years, however, for more significant Chinese investment to come to Peru. We had major mining investments really beginning around 2007. Three of the biggest copper projects in the world are in China, concessions that were purchased by Chinese investors. Peru and China developed a strategic partnership. Peru signed a free trade agreement with China in 2009. And within 2 years, China replaced the United States definitively as Peru's leading trading partner. So it was a real turnaround for Peru, which had historically been much closer to the U.S. in terms of numbers as well as other forms of relationship. Since 2013, we've had a series of bilateral accords that are trying very hard to expand the relationship beyond what has been basically investment in minerals and hydrocarbons, in areas of agriculture, in the areas of cultural educational exchange. The first Chinese bank was authorized to work in Peru. It took several years to get that to happen. And when the Brazilians, for all of their internal problems, decided to sell off the Petrobras assets in Peru, which were significant, the Chinese have also purchased those. So the relationship has really intensified in the last few years. In the Las Bambas project is a very interesting one. If someone wants to look at case studies, Chinese investors purchased a project. It's one of the largest copper projects in the world, which was owned by Glencore Extrait. It was a Swiss-owned operation, and Chinese moved in just a couple of years ago and had taken on an operation that was just getting going. 2015, the Chinese premier came to Peru and announced, among other things, the idea of the bioceanic railway, some huge project running across Brazil and Peru. That those in Peru are skeptical about it, if it's ever going to happen, but it was certainly a step forward in terms of projecting a presence beyond the extractive sectors. Our current situation, just to sort of wrap up the Peru-China relationship, we have a newly elected president who will take office the 28th next week. The president, he's an investment banker, lifetime economist and banker. He has announced that the relationship with China is going to be even more important than it is already. He's announced that his very first state visit after taking office will be to China, which is going to encourage Chinese to invest, to diversify their investments, to invest more and more broadly in Peru. And Chinese investors have already visited and expressed interest in perhaps one of the most controversial, important but controversial smelting projects in Peru, the Dill Run operation in La Oroya. And the president has announced that he's going to lead a march of workers from this smelter down to the Congress to try and get it approved. And this is a very important issue, a very important case, because the smelter has been shut down for a couple of years because of a terrible environmental record, not meeting Peru's own standards for air quality. And the new president has announced that he's got Chinese investors willing to buy it, but he wants to lower the standards in order to get it up and running. So that's a recent project of concern. The balance, as we had, is a significant amount of projected investment by China, a less significant amount of on-the-ground investment. China is not among the top 10 investors in Peru in terms of money on the ground, but certainly in terms of projected in the years ahead, and in the mining industry, it's around 34% of the portfolio projected in the years ahead. Trade with China did quadruple since we signed the free trade agreement. It's highly concentrated in mining and hydrocarbons. There's significant presence in fisheries and forestry as well, but really most of it's about minerals. Most of it's about copper and iron ore. And mining to our economy is significant. So having the Chinese have over a third of the portfolio in one of perhaps our most significant industry in terms of economic growth, again, is a significant change. A significant change economically, also politically and socially, because these are investors that we're not used to dealing with in many ways. 20% of Peru's national territory, to give you an idea, has some kind of mineral concession. That doesn't mean there's mining going on, but it means there's the potential to do so, and concessions are available for private investors, or in this case for investors, transnational investors. China is our number one market, as well as the leading investor in the sector, although all other major multinational mining companies are also present in Peru. So in fact, for our purposes, which are more comparing how China how Chinese companies and investors operate compared to others, it's an ideal situation because pretty much all there on the ground in Peru. We have at least 14 Chinese firms with investments. Only three of them are fully operating mines. The rest are concessions in various forms of exploration or construction. And some are on the drawing board still, some are halted. Our project, our paper, and the online document has maps. They're a little harder to see here of where some of the main projects are. That again point out where there's biodiversity hotspots or indigenous populations, and there are a number of them in these projects. What we did in our case study of Peru, and this is I think a lot of detail that I don't need to go into so much, but what we did was say we're not asking sort of just objectively how did the Chinese firms operate or what has been their impact, but we want to compare them. We have a country, Peru, that has been leading the region in trying to establish new guidelines and new standards for the extractive industries, particularly mining. Peru is the first country from Latin America to get involved in the EITI, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, the first country in South America to comply with the standards of transparency in these industries that initiative puts forward. Peru has created in recent years a new Ministry of the Environment that has a very strong regulatory capacity, increasing capacity to regulate these industries, as well as within its Ministry of Energy and Mines. Peru has established a Ministry of Culture, which has a whole office dedicated to implementing ILO 169, the right to prior consultation for indigenous peoples. Many, if not most, of the mineral investments in Peru are in areas in which the land is owned communally by indigenous people. So when you're talking about mining, you're talking about indigenous populations. And Peru is, since 2011, trying to implement ILO 169, the right to be consulted before a project, before an investment decision is made or before a concession is made. So Peru, in a number of areas, has really been out there trying to combine what are inherently controversial, high-impact, environmentally sensitive industries, with which the economy needs to grow, with new standards about how to make them operate and cleaner, and etc. So what we did was take five different areas of what we call extractive governance reform and compare the Chinese firms in Peru with the other major Western multinationals and the Peruvian national firms that operate in these sectors. And we did a real first cut on this. There's a lot more that can be done, but we tried to take five areas and look at how the Chinese companies stack up. And I'll mention this briefly. One was revenue transparency and distribution. There are really two issues in one category. As I said, Peru joined EITI. This is a voluntary standards initiative in which companies are not obliged to sign on, but in fact, all of the leading companies in the mining industry and the oil industry in Peru signed onto this initiative, except the Chinese. In the first maybe three, four years that this was going on, and I was on the National Commission of the EITI, we would send letters, we would send invitations, the Chinese firms wouldn't answer, they wouldn't come to the meetings. And then something changed, and I think it had to do with Peruvian government's insistence and with a particular Chinese ambassador we had who was outstanding and very concerned about this. The Chinese started answering, saying, we'd love to participate in this initiative, but we don't have authorization from our home countries. And then finally in 2014, they got authorization, and now there are four Chinese firms in this transparency initiative. It's about revenue. So it's a transparency level that looks at how much did you pay in taxes, how much the government says it got, did anything slip under the table, does it match up? Which really shows that the companies are paying what they're supposed to pay legally in taxes. It's not a hugely transparent thing, but symbolically it was extremely important to have the Chinese companies sign on, to have the Chinese embassy in Peru encourage them to do so, and to have them at the table, because a lot of this initiative is involved at negotiations and discussion and getting authorization. Peru has tax secrecy legislation, so no company is obliged to publish what they pay in taxes and different kinds of taxes. It's a secret, so each company each year for these reports has to actually sign a notarized letter authorizing us to have access to that information. So there's a lot of negotiation around that. And the Chinese have finally come to the table. In terms of in distribution of revenues and investments, we discuss in our paper there's only one major Chinese taxpayer in the industry still, which is Shougang, which has been operating since 92. But there's three that are now operating what we call company towns, i.e., the company in two of the three cases actually had to relocate a community, in one case a city, in another case a small rural community, and build a whole new town for them to live in, and then the company is operating and maintaining the town with all of its services, electricity, water, sewage, schools, etc. This is a model that Peru, that Latin America has known from the early 20th century when the United States owned company towns. And ironically now we have three cases in which it's a Chinese firm that operates the town. Significant investment that wasn't necessarily something they expected to have to assume when they invested in a mining project. A second area was voluntary social investment. They kind of overlap there, in which we found the Chinese firms on the whole invest very similar to their other peers in the industry. There's a lot of expectation in Peru that companies should invest voluntarily, i.e. beyond what they may pay in taxes or beyond what an investment agreement requires them to do, because most mining operations are in very remote areas in which the need for basic services is almost absolute. Peruvian state has not reached most of the highlands, areas in which these companies are operating on. And so the creation of social funds and investment funds and local NGOs and foundations is typically expected of mining companies. And the Chinese, as others may grumble about it, had a lot of interviews in which Chinese officials grumble about why our state can't pick up education, why our state can't pick up water and lights in the right. But we found that all in all, they're investing similar or more than their peers from the Western firms. There is one case we looked at, Zijin, Rio Blanco Copper Project, which is a project in which the Chinese did not do due diligence. They purchased this concession. It's very controversial. There's widespread resistance of part of the communities to the mine. They've not been able to get it off the ground. They committed some $80 million in voluntary social investment funds, and the people aren't buying it anyway. So doesn't necessarily get you the license to operate, and it's one particular case we've looked at in which the Chinese were not able to buy them off any more than anybody else was. A third area we looked at was the operation of guilds and multi-stakeholder fora. The mining sector in Peru is one of the leading sectors in terms of social conflict. There's a tremendous amount of social conflict in general around mining, both around environmental concerns and fears, as well as around the distribution of resources and power in a community when a mine is created. Peru has created a series of fora and spaces in which dialogue and negotiation is sought rather than violence. And for the most part, the Chinese have not participated in that. There's a dialogue group, Grupo de Diálogo Minero, in which all of the major companies meet regularly with NGOs, environmental groups, social groups, indigenous groups, to try and discuss and understand the basis of conflict. Only one Chinese firm participates in that. But in fact, the Chinese have created their own association. There is an association of Chinese firms in Peru that we looked at that basically is operating to try and help new investors understand the context and try to help them avoid some of the mistakes of earlier ones. It's a very interesting phenomena. There are four cases in which there have been such significant social conflict that something has been created called a Mesa de Diálogo, which usually is something which the Peruvian government steps in and literally creates a dialogue table that may meet once a month and try and negotiate either the solution to the conflict or try and take the conflict off the table and negotiate what people there need with the hopes that the project will get off the ground once they reach agreements. And we now have four Chinese firms participating in these. These are led by local authorities, municipal or regional authorities, in one case by the Prime Minister's office. The Chinese firms feel that they shouldn't be the ones at the table. It's not their responsibility, but they're participating. And that's a new phenomenon that's very interesting. We looked at labor rights, which I think around the world has been one of the areas of real concern about the Chinese firms, whether they honor the kind of labor standards that many Western countries try and uphold. Peru has, interestingly, Peru has very demanding labor legislation in terms of rights to unionize, minimum wage, minimum hours of the day, social benefits. Peru has a huge informal sector, so many Peruvians actually do not enjoy those labor rights, but for a formal sector, including all large-scale mining, it's probably one of the most well-regulated sectors in terms of the rights of unions, the rights to profit sharing, etc. Most Chinese firms in Peru still have a small workforce. So since there's only three operating mines and the others are in different stages of pre-operation, we can't compare them sort of one-to-one. What we found was the Chinese investors had a hard time with Peru's very militant union tradition. We have trade unions in the mining sector that are very politically radical, very well organized. The Chinese have had a hard time understanding them. But there's really only one case in which it continues to be a problem, which is Shougang, which is a case that we looked at in some depth. For the most part, they've been accepting and understanding that this is the way it is, and you have to understand them. And Chinese firms in the mining sector have had far fewer tertiary workers, i.e. workers who are not formally on the books, than others. A number of large-scale multinational operations in Peru have sort of bypassed the militant trade unions and bypassed the labor codes that we have for mining by hiring a number of people as sort of temporary service workers when they're not necessarily temporary and they're in many cases actually doing core activities. The Chinese have not gone that route, and it's been very interesting. I think they've really wanted to avoid the controversy that that generates with labor, and they've hired more people on the books with full benefits than their Western counterparts so far. The majority of their workers are Peruvian. Only one company, again, Shougang, initially tried bringing in 200 Chinese workers. The protests in the community were such that they lasted less than a year. They were sent back to China. No other Chinese firm has tried to bring in Chinese labor for them in the mining industry. They really hired locally. And again, Shougang is really the one case that stands out for ongoing labor conflict year after year. They have a more hard-nosed approach to dealing with collective negotiation every year. They eventually reach an agreement, but it's almost always a violent strike every year that brings it around, and that's really a kind of exceptional case. And finally, the fifth area we looked at was environmental regulations. And as I said, Peru has a new environmental ministry. It's sort of five years, maybe. And Peru is trying to implement high environmental regulations for air and water quality, for environmental impact assessments before a project is approved. There are several stages a company has to go through. And this has been a learning process for the entire industry, both oil and mining, because it's relatively new for the What we found in the case of the Chinese firms, again, was for the most part compliance. We have large multinational firms. We have Newmont Mining. We have Renko operating a smelter. We have other companies that have been very resistant. For example, refusing to pay fines, taking the government to court, trying to bypass environmental regulations. The Chinese, for the most part, have been compliant. Again, with Shougang perhaps being the worst offender in terms of fines. And we actually did a comparison, it's a little outdated now, of different major mining companies just to give a sense of how they stack up in terms of fines and sanctions for violating environmental standards. The worst up there is Doe Run, which is run by a company based in New Jersey. Buenaventura and Yanacocha is run by Newmont. And we had the Chinese firms sort of in the middle, neither the best nor the worst. We had one case that was very interesting, Chinalco, in which they were just getting up and running. They weren't even in full operation. And they had an acid water spill in a small lake near the operation. What was interesting about that, in an industry where this happens a lot, was that the government was on them immediately, which doesn't always happen. The environmental industry, the environmental agency, UEFA, immediately shut them down. And they immediately shut down. And they cleaned it up the best they could, and they repaired what leaked. And then they asked the environmental ministry to set up a series of training workshops for all of the Chinese firms and the Association of Chinese Companies to try and understand what the regulations were about in Peru. It's not an ideal case. Ideally, we don't want anyone having acid water runoff. But the reaction was very interesting, because both sides did what they're supposed to do in these kinds of cases. I won't go into too much detail, but I think we're sort of... How much time do we have? A few minutes?
You have 10 minutes.
Okay, I don't want to get hot in here. We looked in depth at three cases. If anyone's interested in doing more work, I have a number of other cases I would love to suggest, or comparisons I would love to suggest, because we had a time limit on this project when we all had to produce our work. And we looked at Shougang, as I said, was bought an existing operation in 92. We looked at Zijin and Chinalco, which purchased concessions that were owned by Canadian and British minor junior firms, and they purchased the concessions on the open market and then developed them. And then we had China Main Metals, which we looked at a little more recently, which bought the Las Bambas project in Apurimac. What we found, of course, was a diversity of cases. One of the conclusions of our project was that not all Chinese firms are the same. It sounds simple, but in fact, despite the fact that almost all of them are publicly owned firms that belong to the state in China, they have a series of differences that were very interesting among them, including their relationship to the state in China. We found a fast learning curve. We found that more recent investors very quickly figured out what the mistakes were made by prior investors, including Western ones, seeking out the best consultants for community relations, seeking out the best lawyers, trying to understand the regulations. There was a really intense process of trying to learn, certainly a lot faster than previous generations of foreign investors. An increased engagement and interest by Chinese diplomats who have sought out government regulators, but have also sought out academics like us to try and understand the context and what they really have to do and what's expected of them. I won't go into the cases, I think we have too much, but we gave them subtitles. Shougang was starting on the raw foot, and Shougang really came into Peru in a time before Peru had high standards, when Peru was trying desperately to revive foreign investment in the early 90s. And a number of the conflicts that Shougang has had with this local community and with its workers, we trace back to the starting point, which was very poorly negotiated on both sides, as well as a really real difficulty in this company to overcome some kind of hard-nosed attitudes about dealing with unions in particular, although there have been some improvement even in this case. Chinalco was a company that arrived more recently and that was trying explicitly to comply with the highest global standards in this industry. They hired CEOs from some of the sort of poster child of responsible mining companies, Antamina and others, sought out advice, really, I think, making a very strong effort, both publicity-wise and in terms of investment, to have high standards, both in terms of technical development of the mine and in terms of treatment of workers in local communities. Nonetheless, it's been difficult, and they've not been without problems, and we've been sort of monitoring them over time to see how that goes. And the more recent case was Las Bambas, which we call a work in progress. Las Bambas is, I think, the largest investment that China has in mining in South America. It's a $10 billion projected investment. It's, I think, the second largest copper project in the world today, or known one. And this is a case, in fact, where MinMetals, China MinMetals, which is the owner of the project now, is behind MMG, which is actually based in Australia, and trying to sort of act like a Western company in many ways, including its managers and its hiring practices and its code of ethics, etc. And they've come into a case that's really difficult because they have a rural community that had already negotiated with the Swiss predecessor a series of compliance agreements, a series of investment funds, a series of rights and benefits and compensation agreements, and now they have to renegotiate it all with the Chinese firm. And we've been watching this because it's very interesting to see a firm with a different culture come into a situation where they have to either keep it or renegotiate it in difficult context, and which prices are a lot lower than they were originally. Jumping to some conclusions, the relationship with China is fundamental for Latin America. There's no way, I don't think we're turning back. If anything, it's going to intensify in the years ahead. And for the most part, with a few exceptions, perhaps Mexico, most of our countries aren't prepared. We don't have very many experts in China. We don't know much about China. Our exchange students come to London. They don't go to China. We've got 8 Peruvians from my university studying here this summer, and none of them studying in China. We hope that changes in the years ahead. So it's a relationship we have to understand better, and we have to do it quickly. Our government and our civil society, we have very strong civil society organizations in Peru in environment, social, and labor fields, need to work harder to make sure that this investment not only generates growth or revives growth in some cases, but also is done in a more regulated and socially responsible way. As I said, this has not been to date the result. If you look regionally, as I said at the beginning, the sort of social environmental degradation that has occurred overall with this investment is worrisome, to say the least, worrisome to the Chinese regulators, worrisome to us. But I think the Peruvian case, among the 8 cases we looked at, demonstrates the ability to learn and ability to comply when demands are made on you. And I think our message in our case was that the Chinese are new players who want to play by the books. They want to be in it for the long haul. And the concerns we raise are more about the desperation of our authorities to try and secure and maintain this investment in the context of prices not as favorable as some years ago, and lowering standards on our side in order to keep secure the investment. And that's something we're really cautioning against. We also stress that there's no one Chinese way of doing business. That's a stereotype. We found a variety. And we basically stress, as I said, the need to keep the spotlight on, the need for vigilance on the part of all different actors in our countries and in China, and the need to have this dialogue and this knowledge of China that in many of our countries is still very incipient. And I think I'll leave it there. I think we've talked too much. I'll take some questions.
Thank you, Lindsay.
We're gonna sit down, simply because we're gonna open the floor for questions. In a minute, I'm gonna ask someone if you could turn off the lights a little bit. It's getting dark here. Thank you so much for such a brilliant discussion on the case of Peru, which is very important to us as well. We are conducting a foreign policy analysis of the case of Peru and China, and remember that we call the case, or our program is called Latin America and China. In this case, would be Peru and China. Peru first, because we're analyzing things from the Peruvian side of things. Before I open the floor for questions, I'm just going to ask you one for a very quick question, and then I'll let you ask as many questions as you want. You once said that Chinese investment was in Peru's mining industry was a blessing, but you also said that it was a curse. It's one of my favorite articles. What do you think the new government has to do to make sure that is not going to be a curse in the long term? I mean, the growth of Peru has just been announced 3 days ago. It's expected to be at 4% this year, which is going to be phenomenal for the region. What do you think, what steps need to be taken by the Peruvian government, especially the foreign policy apparatus, to make sure that this is going to be a blessing for the long term?
I think, I'm glad you said foreign policy apparatus, because I think the sectors that I look at, and I come to this because I've been doing a lot of work on the extractive industries and a number of studies on Western firms in the mining industry and transparency and social responsibility. And that's where I came at it, to look at the Chinese investors. But in fact, Peru's mining industry is going to continue to move forward with some of the mega projects that they have on the books, and the new president and his team are going to make every effort to continue promoting that sector. But the bet really is about diversification and about securing investment and engagement in other sectors of our economy, particularly sectors that generate more jobs, sectors that generate more knowledge, sectors that allow Peruvian industry and Peruvian entrepreneurship to be more engaged. And I think one of the keys for that is our ability to train people and to have people who can engage with China. I speak frequently with my counterparts, Chinese researchers, who come usually tasked by the government to try and understand something in Peru. And one of the things that they often ask is, well, what does Peru have to offer? Where should we invest? And you know, fortunately or unfortunately, one of the areas is diversifying within the mining industry. For example, the investment in a smelter. Well, that's for us not a clean investment. That's a very complicated and difficult one. But there's a number of other areas. For example, commercial agriculture in Peru. There's been a boom in selling to China. There's an interest in securing more Chinese investment in commercial agriculture. Commercial agriculture done right in Peru generates an extraordinary number of jobs for low-skilled, medium-skilled people. And like that, there are other sectors in which we're hoping to have more investment. Again, I stress the importance of generating knowledge on our part of China, and vice versa. And one of the things we've been working on is in sort of research and exchange agreement between Chinese universities and institutes and ours. Which is a medium-term strategy, to say the least.
And indeed, you host the first Peru-China Center at the University of Pacific.
We have a small center called the Center for Peru-China Studies. It's because our university is really apostando, betting on this relationship. Peru has three Confucius Institutes that are the Chinese government officially sponsored ones that basically provide language training more than anything else. Ours is focused on economics, business, and international relations. What we're trying to do, there are very few sinologists in Peru. Those that they are largely in the humanities. So we're trying to jumpstart by inviting Chinese scholars to be visitors at our institute, by trying to send our people to China, by encouraging those from third-party countries who work on these relationships to come and be visitors. We love to host researchers. We've had master's and doctoral students coming to our university and at our center. And we've been working with people at CASP, at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, with two of their institutes to do some joint research projects with colleagues in China.
Thank you very much. I'm happy and satisfied with that answer. And I'm going to now let you give you the chance to ask your questions. I'm going to take three questions at a time. We don't have moving microphones, but I'm going to have to ask you to stand up and just speak very loudly. And be brief with your question, and if you could tell us your name and your affiliation, that would be fantastic. So let's start with the gentleman in the back.
Well, my name is Diego, I'm from NSC, and I'm Peruvian.
Peruvian, I see.
Yeah. I come especially paying attention to the governance decline of the presentation. I have two questions.
First, just one for the time being, please. Sorry. Just one for the time being. Just one question.
All right.
Thank you very much, Diego. Second question, please.
Yeah, so this is Manuela, I'm a quality student.
Great.
So would you say that the increasing investment from China means that they have any political influence in the country, and is there any chance that the increased investment can lead to any political involvement from China?
Okay, and I'm going to take some questions in the back. Yes, one more in the back? No? I saw a hand. Okay, Robert, I'm going to give you the chance then.
Thanks. I edit a website called Diálogo Chino, which looks at China's relationship with Latin America from a sustainable development angle. The question was, really, thanks for your presentation, by the way, but really, really interesting to get everything, all the up-to-date research on this. My question is about the recent elections and about the political dynamics in the country now, because the only major party who are resistant to mining on environment environmental grounds are the Frente Amplio, really, the two other main major parties are all for pushing ahead with this mining drive. I wonder what chances you see them having of successfully lobbying for better environmental regulations and getting them implemented.
Fantastic. We're going to stop here for the time being, and we'll get these three questions answered and then come back to you, if that's okay.
Okay. Okay, really good questions. Diego, the whole issue of the relationship between transparency and conflict, it's a really good issue. It's a really good issue to look at more in depth, because within within mining industry and more generally, the idea of being more transparent has been married to the idea of reducing conflict. Once people know what's going on more, they know what the benefits are getting, they know what the different reports and assessments say, they're going to be more satisfied. Well, that's not true at all. I mean, the more transparency you have, if things aren't being run right, generates more knowledge and frustration. And we've found that transparency is fundamental. We think it's an absolutely fundamental issue, that companies and the government are clear about what the projections are, what they're doing, what the environmental impact assessment says, where the company plans to move the people, you know, where they plan to build the plant, etc. But that doesn't necessarily buy you social peace, because with that, you need to have community consultation, prior consultation, engagement, participation, consensus building. There's a series of other issues that come with that. So we think transparency is an important first step. And it's particularly an important step around revenues, because these industries generate huge revenues that often don't get seen on the ground. And it's important for people in communities that are located near these industries to know how much the company's paying in taxes and where it's going. Transparency also about environmental issues. You know, companies need to get environmental impact assessments approved. The central government approves reports that look like this, most of them in English, highly technical. You need to be able to transfer that into materials that people can understand. The process of ILO 169, the process of implementing prior consultation for indigenous and tribal peoples, has been very important. We've had 24 consultation processes in Peru. About half of them have been in hydrocarbons, only three in mining, but they're just getting started. And it requires government authorities to translate, not only in terms of language, but in terms of really cultural understanding to people, what's being proposed before the private investor comes in and takes over. And people don't have the veto power. The Peruvian consultation law doesn't allow them to veto a project, but basically projects now are not going forward if there isn't some acceptance of what's been presented. So I think transparency is fundamental, but transparency doesn't necessarily buy you peace if people can see more what you're doing and they don't like it. So I think that's a really interesting issue. Manuel, you talk about if increasing economic presence of China will be related to political influence. I think it's a question a lot of folks have. And I would say politically, no, in the extent that the Chinese government model, the Chinese political party model, the way China's own government is organized, is not something that they're trying to export. And it's not something, I mean, Peru is a country that has a real shaky and weak relationship with democracy. But certainly sort of democratic politics with all of their flaws are something that's, I think, pretty well rooted in Peru. And I say that knocking on wood. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with it. But the other issue that I think is important is related to what Robert said. Peru does not have a political party system by any sort of stretch. Our parties are long, weak. Most of those who compete for elections are sort of transitory, personalistic movements. And so unlike perhaps in other countries, maybe Cuba, maybe Mexico, where there are parties that have strong relationship with the Communist Party of China, in which there's been a lot of support from the Chinese in terms of training and building cadres and that kind of thing, we don't have that. So for example, when there are explicitly political delegations that go from Latin America to China, from Peru we don't have party people to send, because we don't have a party that looks anything like that. And so it's been more kind of independent engagement of academics, scholars, civil society leaders. So in terms of explicitly China trying to impose on Peru or trying to encourage Peru to follow its political model, we don't see that. Voting with China internationally, Peru recognized PRC a long time ago, so that is an issue. And Peru recognized China's, economic market status a long time ago. But Peru is very independent in terms of other issues. Peru has a, it's interesting, Peru has a long history of supporting every human rights issue in the United Nations that's come forward. And Peru has signed all the charters, and Peru is a very strong defender in its diplomatic corps and its international sphere in terms of human rights, civil rights, women's rights, indigenous rights. Not necessarily always practiced effectively at home, but certainly Peru internationally has not hesitated to support initiatives that some authoritarian countries, including China, have not supported in the same way. Robert's question about the recent elections and what it means for environmental regulation of these kind of industries, that's going to be very interesting. As I said, Peru has a huge space for kind of left, political left. There's a lot of discontent, a lot of folks who feel that, you know, inequality of the current model needs to be changed and stuff. Nonetheless, you know, the electoral results are electing a center-right government that's very strongly pro-market, very strong pro-investment. Pedro Pablo Kuczynski is a lifetime investment banker, well-known among those circles in Latin America. And clearly this government is going to go full steam ahead in terms of encouraging more foreign investment. More foreign investment in the traditional sectors, but I think there's a very strong commitment to trying to encourage investment in other sectors that are not traditional. Services, tourism, as well as what I mentioned, commercial agriculture, light industry. The very first initiative trying to support the Chinese purchasing this smelter is going to be controversial, to say the least. A lot of us are concerned about backtracking that the current government, the Humala administration, has already started to do. There's been a number of supreme decrees passed to kind of relax some of the environmental regulations on new investment initiatives. And one of them flew in the face of the Las Bambas investment. A Chinese firm, China MinMetals, MMG, purchased this huge copper project, Las Bambas. It was originally part of a three-way investment by Glencore Xstrata, in which there was going to be a mineral pipeline underground getting the mineral out, and it was going to be kind of all related among three operations. When the Chinese purchased this operation, that was separated off from what Glencore Xstrata has, and the Chinese decided that they couldn't afford to do a pipeline on their own. But the company before them had already negotiated with every single community along the pipeline. People were already prepared for that. In Peru, people feel pipelines are cleaner than overland trucking of minerals day and night, 24 hours. And they also decided to relocate a plant farther away into the community processing plant. These are issues that have significant environmental impact on the community. These are issues that in the previous legislation would have had to be consulted. There has to be a process of going back to the different communities that are going to be affected and say, we want to change the environmental assessment plan, we want to change our proposal. We're now going to truck the mineral overland instead of doing a pipeline. We're now going to move the plant from here to there. But the Humala administration passed this decree that said that there's a certain number of things you don't have to renegotiate if they're already, if you can make these changes without renegotiating. So the Chinese went ahead and did them. It flew in their face. There were huge protests. The beginning of the year, there was martial law. Three people died from police violence. And the company has had to go back to the bargaining table and say, well, okay, the new law, the new flexibilization in Peru allows us to make these decisions, which are investment decisions, cost-related decisions, without consulting, but in fact the political and social dynamic means you have to consult, you have to negotiate. And they're on the drawing table still with some of these changes they want to make. So I think the incoming administration is clear that you can't relax things too far or you're going to get more conflict again, and you want a project that's going to have 20-30 year lifespan. You need to have good relationship with the communities. You can't just move something or change something because the law allows you to do so. I would just add as an anecdote, the new Minister of the Environment is a close colleague and professor of ours, Elsa Galarza. She was the director of our main research center. She is an environment and natural resource economist, someone who I think is one of the most knowledgeable and savvy people on these issues, who has a really good sense of that delicate balance between promoting investment and regulating it effectively. It doesn't mean the job is easy, but I have confidence in that ministry. Whether that ministry will prevail on these issues or not is something I think a lot of us have to mobilize around.
We have to ask Ricardo Luna.
Yes.
What he has to say, the new foreign minister. And of course, this is a very important year for Peru. I mean, you have APEC summit in November. You also have the possibility of Xi Jinping being in Peru. Mm-hmm. It's not been finalized, but So the big agenda, I suppose, to, in a very short time to prepare it, I suppose the gap in the presidency as well. I'm going to take three more questions. We want in the front, and you remind us your name. Yes, you. Oh, post Brexit.
Yeah. What's the need for climate change? I just want to ask, will the impact of Chinese investment and the government's intention to will the impact of Chinese investment impact Greece's chance to meet the IMDC agreed in COP21?
Okay. Chris?
Yeah, thanks very much. I just wanted to ask you to reflect a little bit on the whole CSR model for corporate social responsibility. Because the usual expected way it works is standards which are held in the domestic environment are then transferred with the production to the other country. So we have a Western firm which one presumes has a set of standards which are higher than the recipient country. And what we have in this case is we're asking Chinese firms to abide by standards which they themselves in their domestic production are not obliged to follow. Now I'm wondering, does this have an impact that you're aware of, the resistance or concern or lack of knowledge in the initial phase and then upping the game, but change the way they do business back home? Do you have any sense of whether it sort of flows, knowledge and learning flows that way?
And one more question from this round. Yes?
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm a recent graduate of international development. My question is, I appreciate you talked a lot about FDI and the current incoming government have their agenda for pro-market sort of policy, but my question is, to what extent do you think it's worthwhile building up indigenous Caribbean firms to deal in the mining sector? And even when you talked about alternative industries, you were talking about Chinese investment or FDI into these alternative industries. To what extent do you think it's worth building up a Caribbean firm in commercial agriculture, et cetera, et cetera?
Very good. I'm going to close it now. We have time for more, probably two more rounds of questions. So we go to you at some point. Please go ahead.
Okay. Questions are getting ever harder.
Welcome to the
LSE. Yeah, I know, geez. My students are pretty tough for professors too. I can't answer, that's futurology, your question. We hope it won't. PRU has a fairly strong environmental movement in civil society. Peruvians have been voting, let's say, center-right in a number of other ways, but I think if you separate out concerns about environment, concerns about climate change, and Peru's one of the countries that's going to be most affected by it and least able to do anything about it, the Peruvian population is very concerned about that as well, and I think that there will be a lot of negotiation with this new administration. One of the things, a former student of mine just recently did a master's thesis on this in Manchester. The environmental ministry and the environmental authorities in Peru are being propped up very significantly by foreign supporters, by international supporters. And they have used effectively international allies, the Germans, the British, the Japanese, European Union, the support both in terms of funding and in terms of kind of political support to negotiate with perhaps stronger actors domestically, like the Ministry of Finance, like the private business sector at home. And I think it will be continually be very important that international development agencies and international allies support the environmental goals and standards that Peru is trying to maintain. So I put that back on some of you as well. The CSR model, there's two parts to that question. The first part I would say is that, like in any industry, I mean, this is the mining industry is about the bottom line, and we've been through a period of incredible bonanza, which is now over for the most part. And in a bonanza period, companies can invest a lot in things that are socially responsible and that win them goodwill and establish positive relationships, and in fact sometimes invest too much in giving away to what people want to try and buy peace. But we're now in a down phase in which companies are much more stringent about what they can invest in. And we haven't seen, you know, the Western firms operating in Peru, as you saw by my chart, are along across the map as well. And, you know, Newmont does not have the world's best record in Peru, and the Renko company has a terrible record in Peru. So they're not all necessarily reproducing standards at home in Peru. What they do have is shareholders who, or the possibility of more shareholder activism and the possibility of people in the home country holding them accountable. So we, you know, we go to China and ask about that. Now, I think it's a research topic that really needs to be done jointly, and I don't know to what extent, I can't assess to what extent Chinese regulators and Chinese government officials or Chinese environmental organizations are being affected in terms of their companies overseas comply, having to meet higher standards. When we went to China to present the results of this project last year, we met with a series of environmental organizations, important NGOs in China. We met with some of the development banks and environmental regulators in the Chinese government, and they all wanted to talk about this. What I think was a tough conversation was that we were told by many of them that we were having first world standards, but we were a third world country. And how did Peru feel they could get, you know, why are we jumping ahead with such high standards when we're still a developing country? And isn't there a trade-off we should be looking more at? And we answered back, you know, that Peru wants to pretend, wants to avoid the mistakes of some other the first world countries that sacrificed a lot of environmental concerns for years. So it was a tough conversation, but we don't know how deep that goes, and I think that's really where we would like to have more counterparts doing research in China that we can engage with. And we're going to have a second round of this project, not with eight teams. I think it's going to be the people at Boston University and UMass, us, and one or two other Latin American teams. We're going to look at Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador, maybe one other country. And we're going to look specifically at the finance side of it. We're going to look at the Chinese development banks and the Western development banks that have incorporated new standards. The chart I showed you, and the Chinese standards have increased significantly, according to our colleagues. We're going to do it with counterparts in China. And we're going to look at some of the projects they're investing in on the ground, both in infrastructure and extraction, to see to what extent the sort of the safeguards and the standards are being held to on the ground, and what either inhibits or helps that happening. So it's going to be an interesting second round in which we're going to try explicitly work with Chinese counterparts. So I don't know if I answered that question effectively. The last question was about developing in indigenous firms or national firms in the sector. Peru has a couple, two or three important transnational Peruvian-owned transnational mining firms that operate in neighboring countries, basically, not so much farther away. The amount of capital and the amount of technology and the amount of skill needed in these large-scale mining projects. We have a lot of medium and small-sized mining, which is almost all national. And in fact, one of the issues on the agenda that we didn't look at, but that's going to be very important in the years ahead, is the sort of tension between large-scale, largely multinational mining and small and medium-scale local miners who are competing increasingly for the same resources. I mean, the small-scale mining has largely been in gold, the multinational has been in copper, but you're seeing some movement there. But for the most part, Peruvian-owned firms, private firms, have not had, that had to partner with larger partners. And we have one case, a gold mine, Yanacocha, which is 51% Newmont, 49% a Peruvian firm. But they really needed those partners with much deeper pockets coming in from outside, and the banks that support them coming in from outside. Well, see, Peru has been a country that has had mining as one of its key motors of development since independence. For the 20th century, it was three large U.S. firms that ran the entire kind of large-scale mining sector in Peru. A radical socialist military government in 1968 nationalized the entire industry, and all of mining and oil was in state-owned firms. Those state-owned firms were run by military government in the 70s. They continued to be run by civilian governments in the 80s. They were run into the ground. It was a very inefficient, ineffective, corrupt system. So when President Fujimori came in the early 90s, he privatized everything again, and he focused on selling it all off, breaking it up, in fact, and selling it off largely to transnational firms. There's a lot of resistance in Peru to going back to state-owned operation. We didn't have anything like Chile with Codel. I mean, Chile has the major actor is a very efficient, well-run state company which can negotiate with anybody. We had very poorly run, inefficient, profit-losing state-owned enterprises, and there's really no traction going back to state-owned operations. As was mentioned here, Robert, we have a small left that I think has got potential to grow in the next few years, but it's not a statist left, it's a green left. It's a left that's more against mining than for state-owned operations. And you see actually more young people more concerned about an agenda that tries to reduce our dependence on those industries than an agenda that talks about having the state have a bigger role. There isn't much political support for that.
We have the chance for another round of questions. And I think someone in the back was, yes, you, please. We don't have that much time, so if you could be brief with the question. Go.
Gabriele, this is the student.
Okay.
You see that Chinese investors learn very fast if they are good and intensive. And what role has been able to provide these incentives to Chinese investors and other countries may know? Has the civil society provided this
or the government, who was being the main actor? Okay, thank you very much, Gabriel. Yes, in the back, I owe you that one, I think.
I'm Felipe, I'm a student here at the NC. I would like to ask you to comment on the establishment of a Chinese satellite space station in Patagonia, which some people claim that it is a base. Do you think that China's economic interests in the region may be hiding second intentions?
That's for Macri to answer, but it will take the question. But, Robert.
Just a very quick one. We haven't spoken at all about the proposed interoceanic railway project.
Very important.
So if you could just give us your thoughts on that, how likely it is to happen, and the potential environmental impact for that.
And to add to that, the impact on foreign policy, our students have been studying this project, actually. So I'll let you answer that, actually. So one more question, and we take one more? No? Yes. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering about this is a very student-y question. What is like the ideal first job after you graduate to enter into something like international trade related or being an ambassador? Because you mentioned that you want more students to go into that field. Is it like making sure you know Mandarin or what are sort of the first things that would help you?
Okay. And your name is?
Diane.
Diane, thank you. I think that's it for now. Let's start with Gabrielle's question about incentives.
Okay, that's a very good question. Because we would like to think that our government authorities are consistent and coherent and emphatic in encouraging all firms to comply with the standards. We'd all like them to do so, but in fact there's been a lot of variation. As I said, that the Humala administration came in with a strong regulatory agenda, and within a year they basically started rolling it back in order to encourage investment by trying to lower some standards. And it's really been a combination of civil society mobilization, international mobilization, so international actors, particularly environmentalists, supporting and development agencies largely from Western countries, supporting local actors, and also within the private sector. As I said, the Association of Chinese Companies in Peru has really served a function of sort of new investors who arrive and don't understand the context or don't understand some issue are finding that their cohort is also very helpful in suggesting consultants and suggesting how to get around the context that they've been operating in, more so than their Peruvian counterparts. So we don't see a lot of relationship between the Peruvian miners and the Chinese miners. If anything, the Peruvian miners have been very resentful of the Chinese actors. It's kind of interesting. You don't see anti-China sentiment in Peru. Quite the contrary, Peruvians have a perfectly positive view of China. I mean, there's been a colleague of mine does public opinion surveys, and Peruvians largely look very positively on China, even when their cultural orientation is much more U.S. But the mining industry in Peru, for example, looks upon the Chinese with a great deal of skepticism. They don't play by the same game. They don't do the same. They don't go to the same clubs and drink with the same people. I mean, it's been very kind of the Peruvian miners are a very close set. But the Chinese companies themselves, civil society organizations, and some agencies within government, the trade agencies, the environmental ministry. I had a very good discussion with the Vice Minister of Environment, who has sat down with Chinese companies and gone over what are the regulations of what you need to know, and you know, how to avoid getting fines and that kind of thing. There's also a growth industry of consultants in Peru. I mean, talk about jobs. Go back to that. Man, we can't keep them in academia. You know, there's a huge demand both for lawyers, engineers, but also for social scientists and people who know anything about these issues. There's an awful lot of consulting going on, and the Chinese have learned to consult. One of the cases we looked at that was really interesting was Chinanco, the Toromocho case, which is the first and most important voluntary relocation of a town in Peru in many years. In the old days, both under the Americans and then under the state-owned enterprises, when it was time to build a mine, you just picked people up and moved them, right? And now it has to be voluntary, it has to be negotiated, there has to be compensation, it's very difficult. And the Chinese bought into an operation in which a Canadian junior had the concession and had hired a consulting firm that's very good to start a consultation process with the community. A community of about 5,000 people that had to be moved. And they had to be moved a fairly short distance, but they had to move out of the way to build the mine. And they had begun a whole process of very participatory, very transparent consulting about where they wanted to go, what kind of housing they wanted, what kind of services they wanted. And the Chinese came in, and I think my interviews, the first reaction was, this is expensive. You know, why do we want to do this? This is something the government should do. And the Peruvian government actually negotiated that they're going to have the Chinese pay for all of this. Like over $50 million they invested in the whole move, in the whole relocation process. But they decided to keep the consultants on. They decided to continue to support the process. At the same time, they built up their own community relations staff. So when the relocation went forward, and it was fairly successful. There was a small group of holdouts, but the majority of people agreed to move, and the others are taking their time. But once that was over and the consultancy was over, the movement was done, the Chinese company, Shinago, has to set up a sort of small community relations office that also has people who are very good. And I think they really kind of learned by looking at other cases that have not been so successful. So I guess that answers that question. I can't answer any question about the Chinese space station in Patagonia. I would be very interested if somebody could. And I mean, I take that seriously. I mean, I think there's always this concern of what other motives are out there besides trade and investment. And is it a good or a bad thing for us? Is it a maldición or a bendición?
That's right.
But I don't know anything about that issue.
We're conducting some research on Argentina and China, and that would be one of the cases that we'll actually be looking at. So please get back to us, and we'll be happy to. Because MACRI is deeply concerned about it, especially with the change, of course, and they don't know how it was negotiated, et cetera, et cetera.
But MACRI, I mean, he has, I guess his father, and they have very strong relations with China, right? Talk about a change in culture, economic, everything. I mean, Argentina, you know, has just become a soy producer for China in a big way. That has a huge impact in Argentina.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be Argentines here who know better than I do, but I was really struck because I hadn't been in Argentina for a while. I hadn't been that much in touch with my colleagues in Argentina, and the people at the UBA who were working with us, it's a profound change in many levels, the relationship with China and Argentina. There was a question about the railroad, and we're trying to follow it. You know, given all the problems in Brazil and given the change of government in Peru, what we don't see is any traction at all on our side. We had a roundtable discussion in the beginning of the year at our university with the Chinese ambassador, with people from the Chinese government, from CAS, who came over. It was a team of researchers who were tasked to monitor this project and to monitor what Peru was going to do about it and Brazil. And we were told, both by the Chinese and by the Ministry of Transportation in Peru, that definitively the impact assessment and the projected studies were going to be available in May. You know, May came and went, and there's no published anything. They didn't say which year. I mean, and in Peru, it's just not going anywhere. And the Ministry of Transportation is on the way out. I don't think Peru ever had a lot of enthusiasm about this. I think Pedro Pablo Kuczynski would probably like the project. It hasn't been one he's mentioned yet. Infrastructure is a big issue in Peru anyway, and that's a big item on his agenda. But I don't see it happening in the short term. And in terms of the environmental implications, they're huge. I mean, on one hand, there are environmentalists who say that rail transportation is better than overland transportation, but they're talking about two different routes, as you know, and one route goes through, well, Bolivia is the third route, because Bolivians want in on this as well. They've got German investors, I guess. But one route would go through very vulnerable sort of biodiversity areas, and also going through constructing railroad in the Amazon is not easy, no matter what. One route would go through more indigenous areas of indigenous population, which are socially very vulnerable. So neither of them is ideal. And there hadn't been a decision on which route would be taken. And I can't believe that they've been able to pull off significant assessments of what the impact are in this amount of time. I think it's going to take a lot more effort. But I think this administration would be favorable if this goes, if there's traction behind this from the Chinese still. I don't know what's happening in Brazil. And the final was the employment question, and I think that's a really good one, because trying to encourage our students, as I said, to get more interested in China and the relationship with China, and more broadly the relationship with the different Asia-Pacific countries with which we engage. The diplomatic route in Peru is much more formalized and standard. You have to go to the diplomatic academy. You do an undergraduate degree, and then you go to the diplomatic academy, and it really career diplomats are a different line. And unfortunately, as far as I understand, in our diplomatic corps, there are very few people who speak Mandarin, very few people trained in China, and we need to supplement that with people who come from other sectors besides the formal diplomatic academy. But our professionals in economics and in business and international relations, there's a lot of demand in Peru now for young, talented professionals with technical skills and international knowledge. If someone has Mandarin and has knows something about China, the jobs are there for the asking. We've been trying to recruit faculty who can teach about China in our university, who have some experience there, and every time we identify somebody, they get, you know, snapped up with a six-figure income by a Chinese company, and we lose them. You know, they lecture part-time. But it's a skill that's very hard to acquire, as you know. It's not like learning English, which is pretty easy. Learning Chinese is hard. But we've seen a lot of interest from our students who are Chinese descendant. We have, you know, a lot of Tucson, a lot of second and third generation Chinese students in our university and others. The desire to know more about the country of their ancestors, the desire to go back. I had a student, a brilliant student in one of my classes last year, who had been to China 14 times before he went to college, visiting family. And he's got a garment sportswear company that he started, and he's trying to sell back to China. So you see a lot of interest on the part of those who have some advantage anyway. We have two Chinese language schools in Peru, high schools that teach in Chinese and English, and those kids really have a leg up. So we're trying to work with them as well.
Yes, the emphasis is in Cantonese, I understand it.
The original immigrant population is okay. But for example, there's two Chinese schools in which learning a certain minimum level of Mandarin is required. And I do admissions interviews, and I find students who are, you know, 17, 16, 17 years old and have some rudimentary knowledge. Certainly a lot more interest on the part of families. There's a lot of families also that didn't want to know anything. My co-author and researcher, Victoria Chong, her parents are Chinese immigrants to Peru. And it's interesting, there's a Chinese population in Iquitos in the Amazon jungle. They came directly from China to, and I don't remember which part of China, to Iquitos. They didn't come to the capital city. And she grew up in the Amazon in Iquitos, and she didn't come to Lima until it was time for secondary school. Her parents didn't want to talk about China at all. I mean, they were running away. But her grandma taught her some language, and she got interested, and she went to the University of Michigan to do an MA degree and decided to major in Chinese studies, and her parents were horrified because they didn't want to open that box. But she's a trilingual, you know, English, Spanish, Chinese, and now she's doing a doctorate in international relations. And it's kind of part of that generation that wants to reopen that relationship.
We could go on and on the whole night, but before you leave, I want to thank you for being here, Professor Alden, and I am delighted to have you here. You too, by the way, without you, we wouldn't have been able to have such a vibrant event tonight. And we'll invite you to visit our website to look at our new Latin America and China program. And I'm very delighted personally, you know, I'm very close to Universidad del Pacifico. And of course, if you're thinking about going to Lima, don't think it twice. It's an incredible, amazing place. But I want you to join me in thanking Professor Sanborn for her incredible presentation. And that's it, with a big applause.